Get show notes of this podcast and all of the others at j-doherty.com/JD Podcast. Coming up.
The people of this nation have spoken. They've delivered us a clear victory, a convincing victory, a victory for we the people. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies, they are Americans.
A historic vice president-elect in Kamala Harris, the first woman, the first black woman, the first Indian American woman, the first daughter of immigrants to be sworn in as vice president of the United States.
No matter who you voted for, I will strive to be a vice president like Joe was to President Obama, loyal, honest, and prepared.
TJDP 2020 presidential election coverage, only on the JD Media Network.
The J. Doherty Podcast, episode number 137, The Path Ahead.
Today on the J. Doherty Podcast.
A moral victory for America. Joe Biden has secured the 270 electoral votes needed to become the 46th president of the United States of America. Analysis and updates of the elections unfolding is next. President Trump's dangerous and inaccurate response to the election results as they were coming in has even some Republicans, and obviously Democrats, condemning his actions. President-elect Biden claims he has already begun work on his administration and insists on the importance of a free, fair, and fully counted election. What can the current president do in a legal setting to try and prove his point? What precedent does contesting election results set in America? What will a Biden-Harris administration look and feel like? And what is going to happen next? We'll try to answer all that and more on episode number 137 of the J. Doherty Podcast.
This is the J. Doherty Podcast. Here's J. Doherty.
Yes, that is correct, everyone. Thank you very much for being here. This is the J. Doherty Podcast, episode number 137, Sunday, November 8th, 2020, 4:24 p.m. as we come on the air and record on the podcast. Thank you very much for being here. I very much appreciate it. There has been what I am calling a moral victory for America, what I think is a moral victory for America. Joe Biden has secured the 270 electoral votes needed to become the 46th president of the United States. This is a fantastic victory, in my opinion, for the United States, for the world, really. I mean, just not even Biden himself. I mean, although he is much better than Trump, just getting Trump out of the office is fantastic. And I think behind closed doors, Republicans agree with that. And obviously, in the open and public, Democrats definitely agree with that as well. It is a fantastic thing to have a center-left person in the office as well. Hopefully, he stays center-left and is not overtaken by any... I hope he stays his path and stays with the center-left, moderate Democrat philosophy that he's always carried through in his 43 trillion years in Congress and all of his experience in politics. If he stays center-left and he minds his own center lane, that will be a successful presidency, among many other things, which I'm going to talk about very shortly. But before I do, I want to let you know that you can get up to the minute 2020 election updates on thedohertyfiles.com, which is a JD Media Network site. Hear 2020 presidential election night unfold as it did live on election night on episode number 136 of the J. Doherty Podcast at j-doherty.com/136. First, I want to say that 60% of this podcast will be taken up by me talking about what led up to Biden's victory in the form of chronologically going through how the media, Republicans, Democrats reacted to Trump's very, 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 very slowly revealed loss. So if you would prefer to jump to my breakdown of Biden's victory, please go to j-doherty.com/137 and skip to whatever timestamp my coverage of Biden's victory begins at in this episode. And if you don't want to do that, you can just go to thedohertyfiles.com where the topic of Trump's antics about voter fraud is the first topic, and then the second topic is Joe Biden's victory. The only reason Trump's antics come first is because that's what happened chronologically first, even though it continues to happen. But look, before we get into going through the chronologically the way the election unfolded after episode 136. I want to talk about the ratings of election night. That is very important, isn't it? An estimated 56.9 million people watched election 2020 coverage during primetime across 21 networks with out-of-home viewing as well as connected TV viewing in total, the CTVs contributing as much as 11%. The 56.9 million total was down from the 71 million viewers who tuned into the 13 networks that covered the election results in primetime on November 8, 2016. Some 66.8 million viewers watched live election coverage of President Barack Obama's re-election victory over Mitt Romney on over 13 networks from 8 to 11 p.m. on November 6, 2012. All of what I just said is according to Deadline.com. While overall viewership was down, Fox News's 2020 viewership set a new high. Their primetime coverage of election night 2020 topped all television networks and set a record for the most watched election night coverage in all of cable news history. FNC's primetime coverage averaged 13.7 million viewers and nearly 5 million in the 25 to 54 demographic, beating ABC, NBC, CBS, and all cable networks in both. CNN had 9.1 million viewers, and they were second for the night in viewership, followed by MSNBC, which had 7.3 million, ABC, 6.1 million, and NBC, 5.6 million. So the ranking, according to Deadline, reflects the current dominance of the cable news networks over political coverage. 4 years ago, NBC was the most watched network on election night, 12.1 million viewers, followed by Fox News, 11.5 million viewers. So that just shows that there is a big market still for Trump praise and Trump hatred. There's a big market for very biased political coverage right now. And really, that's sort of going to go away. And the Trump praisers who like to watch Fox News was very, what a lot of conservatives are saying, oh, they were very premature in the way that they called a lot of the states, or at least they were willing to take un-Fox News-like risks in order, you know, when they were calling states and making decision desk predictions, which I'm going to soon talk about. You can read the full ratings article at deadline.com, or you can go to the j-story.com/137 and get the direct hyperlink for that as well. So as promised, we will pick up right where we left off on episode number 136, and the one shocker that I just alluded to that happened almost immediately after the end of TJDP's coverage of that night was Fox News calling Arizona a victory for Biden. They were the first major broadcast publication to do so, and the rest followed after. They, of course, are a very conservative outlet, to say the least, and Trump supporters were enraged at them for not only calling the state, but also doubling down on their call. Lots of anger actually came from Trump supporters. Trump ally and esteemed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was on Sean Hannity's show in the aftermath of the election and was squawking his head off about how Fox News should rescind their call, even though it ended up pretty much being correct.
The Arizona call you just showed, Trump is gaining in Arizona. There's probably 500,000. So here's my thing, Sean. If you're going to be quick on the trigger, then be quick on the trigger for both sides and stand by it. But it seems like with Trump, they never want to call the state. And then Biden, man, they'll do it right away. It's inconsistent. It's unacceptable.
Now, perhaps that doesn't really make a difference, but the real interesting thing here is how Fox News has, for 85% of Trump's administration, has sort of been a safe haven for Trump, for DeSantis, for his supporters, for Trump's supporters, but they ended up taking a lot more risks in the liberal direction in their election night coverage, and they were very unapologetically centered, I would argue, in most of their coverage. This led to seemingly, you know, out-of-place chant, a very definitely paradoxical chant of Trump supporters, which MSNBC's Gadi Schwartz happened to capture on November 4th. They were chanting, "Fox News sucks." Here is Gadi Schwartz on MSNBC on November 4th.
And they're actually chanting, "Fox News sucks. Fox News sucks." The reason why they're chanting that is because Fox News called Arizona for Biden yesterday, and a lot of people are angry about that. We have not called Arizona. A lot of other organizations have made that decision not to call Arizona. It is much too close right now, but this is a scene outside of the Maricopa Election Center, and we're going to keep an eye on it.
Okay, so, I mean, isn't that paradoxical? You're used to hearing them shout CNN sucks like they have at his rallies, of course. that's the best clip I could find. It's hard to make out often, but you're used to hearing them shout CNN sucks at rallies, and now they're, you know, because CNN is so liberal, and then now you hear him shout Fox News sucks, and that's a very, very different thing. Very, very different thing. Something that, you know, basically there's Fox News is no longer the haven for Trump. At least that was their thinking behind that phrase. And really, well, I'm going to talk about this in a second. Now that Trump has been voted out, now that, you know, he's no longer the president, or he's no longer soon to be the president. First of all, I don't think he's going to do a lick of work until, you know, he's not going to do any more work until, you know, he's out of office. If he does any work after that, who knows? And so I think he's just going to, you know, suffer from the pain of irrelevance, because no one from the Senate is going to call him anymore unless they need to get something done. The media networks have no reason to hold on to him really much anymore, other than cover his administration and any failures that he has, because that gets fantastic ratings for a lot of the Trump-hating networks, CNN, MSNBC. They do very well in very, very political coverage. And Fox News equally does well. They've been consistent number one in the ratings, not just in election night, but overall. They've been very consistent because they are the only conservative network that's sort of pro-Trump, and all the other ones are liberal. So if you add up all the liberal networks, and then you add up all the, and then you take Fox News, which is the only conservative network, liberal coverage is very dominant in the media. But if you look at, you know, just Fox News, they overall outnumber everyone. And in the ratings, when they do Trump hatred and that sort of thing on the networks, that does fantastic ratings, which is sort of interesting because a lot of the media networks pushed Biden. They wanted Biden to win, but that's not good for their business model. So I don't know. It's an interesting sort of paradox. But back to what I was talking about with Fox News. Arnon Mishkin is Fox News's decision desk director. And back to the reason they were chanting Fox News sucks, here's what he had to say to defend the network's decision for calling Arizona. This is a slightly edited, condensed version of what he had to say on the day that they were chanting Fox News sucks.
Arizona, shoot. Are you 100% sure of that call and when you made it and why did you make it?
Absolutely. We made it after basically a half hour of debating. Is it time yet? Because it's been clear for a while that the former vice president is in the lead in Arizona and was most likely to win the state. It has been in the category that we call knowable but not callable for about an hour. We're right now sitting on a race that is Biden at 53%, Trump at 46%. I'm sorry, the president is not going to be able to take over and win enough votes to eliminate that 7-point lead that the former vice president has.
Okay, so that, you know, he doubled down on the statements. He did not retract it. He did not buy into the conservative urging to retract it. And it did end up being true, because a lot of the public, a lot of networks and AP and other publications ended up calling Arizona a couple hours after that, a couple days after that. So Fox News was just the first, and that drew a lot of conservative eyes to be critical of it. All right, so I think we've covered pretty much everything in terms of networks and the flash and the let's say, what do we call it? The outrage that Fox News received for calling Arizona so early. So now let's move on to Trump's claims of voter fraud. So this is a really interesting thing. And voter fraud is a very serious thing if it exists. However, there is no evidence that wide-scale voter fraud has existed. The Trump campaign has provided no evidence of that. They say they give us time. Ron McDaniel, which we'll talk about, has said just give us time to produce the evidence. Trump is going to claim all this stuff with no evidence, but we will soon have evidence, which is going to be very, very interesting. Trump had been hinting at the potential for voter fraud leading up to the election, and inevitability that would occur, of course, only if he was the supposed loser of the election. Those concerns flared as the nightmare of losing the election was nearing for Trump. Here's one of the first of many things he has said about voter fraud. While ballots were, and of course still are, being counted. This was about 2 a.m. Eastern time at the White House in the non-socially distant and very, very maskless East Room of the White House.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
Now, of course, that is not true by any stretch of the imagination. As of today, Sunday, November 8th, neither Biden or Trump have won the election officially. And, I mean, officially, but it is impossible, basically, for Trump. Every single vote would have to would have to go in Trump's favor that hasn't been counted yet to go for Biden, even though, and the possibility of the, if you look at the statistical possibility of Biden victory, I mean, it's almost inevitable. And so when I say Biden victory, when all the networks say Biden victory, it really is not an official Biden victory because the media calls those victories, but it would be nearly impossible for Trump to even to win the election. CNN was the first one to call that that Biden had won the election. So, I mean, they haven't won. Biden has not officially won, but it is, again, it's like pretty much impossible for Trump to win. There is, according to the New York Times, no evidence of voter fraud. And I'm going to get to an article from the New York Times in a second. You know, if ballots were submitted on time, but then counted late, and then Trump suggests that the counting of the ballots being counted late is bad, so it plays in favor, or at least doesn't add to the risk of opposing his favor, that is voter suppression, not voter fraud. And frankly, no one even knows what evidence Trump cites when he says things like this, on top of the fact that if he used the very infamous and recently created Stop the Count hashtag, he still would have lost. If they stopped the count, which again would be voter suppression because you're neglecting votes that were submitted on time, and you're getting rid of votes that you know, people, like legitimate American votes that were legally submitted on time. You know, if you do that and you tell him to stop counting, first of all, that's not correct. It's not moral. It's illegal. But the second thing is that it's not that he would have lost. He would have definitely lost if they stopped the count. If they stopped the entire count, Joe Biden in the like last third of the entire election night's unfolding, at least in terms of state developments, had an electoral college lead over Trump drastically. So I don't know what he was talking about when he said stop the count. Perhaps the closest thing we do get to Trump citing evidence is when, in that same election night speech in the East Room, he first says that it was Democrats' grand evil plan to take legal action against him if there was any potential for Democrat loss. And when he says they in the following clip, he is referring to Democrats. Here he is.
They knew they couldn't win, so they said, let's go to court. And did I predict this, Newt? Did I say this? I've been saying this from the day I heard they were going to send out tens of millions of ballots. I said exactly, because either they were going to win, or if they didn't win, they'll take us to court.
Okay, so remember that quote in your mind. Either they were going to win, and if they didn't win, they'll take us to court. Just remember that in your mind. I think he was actually reading his strategy for the aftermath of his defeat instead of his victory speech there, which actually wasn't obviously a victory speech, because literally minutes after saying that Democrats' grand plan from the beginning was to take legal action in the face of their defeat, and the crowd pities the Democrats with disgust, Trump says he's going to do literally the exact same thing, and soon after achieves roaring applause from his steadfast supporters.
This is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list. Okay?
Okay, so first of all, I think he means counting, or at least I hope he means counting. Otherwise, he's drastically uninformed about how voting and elections and counting actually works. But you have to remember, more importantly, that less than 2 minutes before that, he said a less concise version of this.
They knew they couldn't win, so they said, let's go to court, because either they were going to win, or if they didn't win, they'll take us to court.
Okay, so Trump didn't win, and he's taking them to court. So he's literally using the precise strategy that he laid out for Democrats if they were to lose. And he sort of accuses them of being the sore losers if they enact that strategy, yet he enacts the exact same strategy. And when he does it, the supporters clap. When they do it, it's disgusting and illegal. And when Trump says the following,
we don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list. Okay?
Okay, so that's a ridiculous thing to say. Does he not recall in 2016, according to factcheck.org and the New York Times, that 22 states, including 12 won by Trump in
2016,
accepted postmarked mail-in ballots after Election Day? And that's a jam a cappella there. Anytime I mention a year in a somewhat comedic sense, I will play an a cappella from Jam. So anyway, if Trump had Biden's numbers and Biden had Trump's numbers, you wouldn't be hearing a single word from Trump about voter fraud. I mean, it seems like in Trump's land, it's only fair if he wins. I'm sure he just says, it's only fair if I win. That's the mentality he has. And I think that's a direct quote from Vladimir Putin. That's sarcasm. Another lie of this speech, according to factcheck.org, was about unsolicited ballots. And this really gets into the hypocrisy of Donald J. Trump. Because according to factcheck.org and what they say about unsolicited ballots, as he has for months, Trump railed against what he has called unsolicited ballots or states where mail-in ballots were sent to all registered voters. But of the remaining states still in question on Wednesday morning, only Nevada had sent mail-in ballots to all registered voters. As they have reported, only 9 states and the District of Columbia mailed ballots to about 44 million registered voters for the November election. Those states, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, were California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, New Jersey, Oregon, Utah, Vermont, and Washington. And of those, only Nevada had not been called by the AP for either Biden or Trump as of Wednesday morning. So Trump has said that he has no problem with mail-in ballots. He literally said that he has no problem with mail-in ballots when they were requested by voters. He said that solicited is good, and he basically praised the existence of voter ballots in the same 2020 election, the one that we're in right now, and he said it at a rally, actually. So here he is, and again, he contradicts himself when he's losing, but this is what he said at a rally in October, late October of 2020.
I say solicited is good. That's where you write in, you want, they send it to you, you know, etc. Which still is not as good as being there, but it's pretty good.
Okay, so that is how the mail-in ballot process has worked in almost all of the remaining undecided states, according to factcheck.org. Some states, such as Arizona, Georgia, and Michigan, sent absentee or mail-in ballot applications, not actual ballots, to registered voters. And other states that still hang in the balance, such as North Carolina and Pennsylvania, voters had to request mail-in ballots independently. And by the way, that rally was in Manchester, New Jersey on October 25th. So there's Trump's antics about the insanity of his election and voter fraud claims that he made. But now let's talk about the days after the election night. So the public appearance that the president had after this election night speak, I think the first one or the next one after, was when he went into the press briefing room and delivered what left-wing CNN analyst Daniel Dale calls the most dishonest speech of his presidency. And 18 seconds into Trump's speech, he baselessly claimed that Democrats are trying to, quote-unquote, steal the election.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us.
Okay, that's not true. And in advance of the press conference, according to Ashley Parker and Josh Dossi over at the Washington Post, allies and advisors counseled caution, trying to assuage Trump by outlining their aggressive plan to fight and urging him to keep a low profile, something that is literally impossible for Trump to do. But, they write, on Thursday evening, the president appeared in front of reporters at the White House around 6:45, seeming subdued and deflated, and made unproven claims about voter fraud and vowing to continue the fight through legal channels. He mocked mail-in ballots and polling from the news media and said falsely that states were making up ballots to cost him the election. He made a series of other unsubstantiated allegations against Democratic elections, and at one point, Trump said that states that counted the votes were behaving in a corrupt manner, while Arizona needed to count the ballots so he could win. He walked away without taking questions, and a senior campaign official said Thursday night's appearance was the kind of news conference they wanted to avoid. That's coverage from Ashley Parker and Josh Dossi over at the Washington Post. Other lies were also spread during that press conference as well. There's a lot to get into, probably too much for this episode because of the insane amount of lies in that press conference, but there are at least a dozen of other lies confirmed by fact-checking sources such as factcheck.org and others out there. The other thing that his voter fraud claims do, perhaps more importantly, is they create a new source of division in the Republican Party. And if you look at the way that these parties, the two-party system right now is working, you have the Democrat Party is extremely divided. You have super progressives, and then you have the quiet island of moderate Democrats like Joe Biden. The super progressives are like Senator Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and sort of her squad, as she's deemed it. Then you have more moderate Democrats like Joe Biden and others who believe in sort of the old school idea of moderate Democrats and, you know, socially liberal philosophy, helping the next person up the ladder sort of idea instead of just having the government intervene in every single, you know, thing in your life. And the progressives tend to think that socialism or socialist, or an increase in socialist policies is a good thing. Biden does not believe that, which is a good thing. And, you know, center left is basically what Biden is. And a lot of their party is not center left. So that is just a recipe for raw division. However, if you look at Trump, and this is typical, as I talked about, I think on episode number 134 or 135, the incumbent party in an election is generally less divided than the party that is trying to contest the or trying to win the seat in the White House. So hopefully Joe Biden will sort of be the pendulum that brings the party back to center left, particularly with his nomination of Kamala Harris, who is very much more progressive than he is. But now that we're going into another election cycle and a Democrat has won the office of the presidency, it is inevitable that Republicans are going to be more divided. I think that Republicans hate Trump behind the closed doors of the Senate. I think he is a loose cannon. I think he contradicts their policy. Yeah, maybe he goes along with it because his advisors tell him to do that, but he is a loose cannon for the Republican Party, and they are, in my opinion, I think they're just going to ditch him the second Joe Biden gets sworn into office. He is going to suffer very badly, and as he already is doing, from the pain of irrelevance. But the problem is that, even if with Trump being gone, the Republicans now have a new source of division in their party, which is Trump's insane voter fraud claims. All of these baseless allegations and lawsuits about voter fraud, which he's filed, are very controversial. And more than anything, they point to Trump's unbacked sore loserness, which I think one of the press members asked him as he was walking out of that press conference that I was just talking about, whether he's a sore loser. The problem really is all of the lawsuits and the legal action that Trump is taking on top of his rhetoric. He's filing lawsuits in states that he didn't win, and the pain of his irrelevance is starting to set in, and he does not want to accept that fact. And really, the amusing thing is that Trump doesn't know much about the policies that he pushes, which are generally conservative, Republican-expected policies, something that he could have campaigned on more. If he campaigned on the reasonable conservative, and instead of just shoving his personality down everyone's throats, he probably would have done better in this election. By contrast, he seems to sort of be taking the lead on something that he is much better, knows a lot more about, suing people. Well, in this case, states. According to the AP, Trump's campaign filed lawsuits on Wednesday in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, laying the groundwork for contesting battleground states as he slipped behind Democrat Joe Biden in the hunt for the 270 Electoral College votes needed to win the White House. The new filings, joining existing Republican legal challenges in Pennsylvania and Nevada, demand better access for campaign observers to locations where ballots are being processed and counted, and raise absentee ballot concerns, according to the campaign. However, one Michigan location in question in the Associated Press observed poll watchers from both sides monitoring on Wednesday. And you can read the AP article as well. They go on to say that the Trump campaign is also seeking to intervene in a Pennsylvania case at the Supreme Court that deals with whether ballots received up to 3 days after the election can be counted, according to Deputy Campaign Manager Justin Clark. The actions reveal an emerging legal strategy that the president has signaled for weeks, namely that he would attack the integrity of the voting process in states where the result could mean his defeat. In other words, if I win, yeah, that's great and it's fair. If I don't, it's unfair. His campaign also announced that it would ask for a recount in Wisconsin, a state that the AP called for Biden on Wednesday afternoon. Campaign manager Bill Stepien cited irregularities in several Wisconsin counties, unquote, without providing specifics. So the way the AP uses the phrase without providing specifics is really a euphemism for not citing evidence and making unsubstantiated claims. Biden also said Wednesday that the count should continue in all states, adding, "No one's going to take our democracy away from us, not now, not ever." Campaign spokesman Andrew Bates said legal challenges were not the behavior of a winning campaign. Bates said in a statement that what makes these charades especially pathetic is that while Trump is demanding recounts in places he's already lost, he's simultaneously engaged in fruitless attempts to halt the counting of votes in other states which he's on the road to defeat, which is absolutely true. Election officials continued to count votes across the country, the normal process on the day following voting, so they basically haven't listened to Trump by any stretch of the imagination, and a lot of these lawsuits that he's filing are really sort of just general calls for more fairness and access to voting without really any evidence of actual voter fraud that happened, particularly in this election. According to the AP, unlike in previous years, states were contending with an avalanche of mail-in ballots driven by fears of voting in person during a pandemic. At least 103 million people voted early, either in mail or by mail or in person, which represents 74% of the total votes cast in the 2016 presidential election. So, super high voter turnout in this election, which is sort of an interesting thing to see. According to the AP, there have been no reports of fraud or any type of ballot concerns out of Pennsylvania, which is another state that Trump, of course, is suing. And the state had 3.1 million mail-in ballots that take time to count, and an order allows them to be received and counted up until Friday if they're postmarked by November 3rd. There are a bunch of interviews from the Secretary of State's in Michigan, the Attorney General's in, you know, each state, and they're all sort of going against what Trump is saying, you know, we want fairness in our elections. And, you know, we don't need Donald J. Trump to tell us that our elections are unfair. And you can read that full, very long article that was fantastic over by Mark Sherman at the AP. It's called Trump Sues in Three States, Laying Ground for Contesting an Outcome. You can find the direct link at j-torty.com/137. The other interesting thing is RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel. She did her best to defend Trump's claims of voter fraud, sticking by him, essentially, without evidence, on Bret Baier's Fox News show. And Bret Baier just came back with a fantastic, very level-headed response, and more importantly, true response at the end of the following clip.
Are you saying that you're going to come forward in this press conference with something that's going to change the dynamic of 147,000 ballots?
I'm saying be patient and allow us to pursue these irregularities and some of these allegations that are very serious, And so allow that to happen. Let the process take place. It's funny that we rush to judgment. We want to get this election over with. But if there is election fraud, which everyone accuses or says there wasn't, or if there were these irregularities, we need to pursue them. And I've had so many reports come in, and some of them are very, very serious. We need to go down that avenue and make sure that every vote that was legal is counted, but also that there weren't attempts to subvert the vote of people who were voting.
We agree with you, and we want to look into everything as well, but we just haven't seen it.
That's precisely the case. Everyone wants to have a free and fair election, and you know, there's just no evidence of that there was subversion of a vote or anything like that. The other thing that's really interesting is that they only think it's fraudulent if Trump doesn't win. So that should just be a major red flag right there. If Trump won and it was fraudulent, would he accept that it was fraud and would he say the same thing? No, absolutely not. Probably not. So that's sort of an interesting thing. And I thought Bret Baier's response, again, he's very conservative on a very conservative network. He said, we just haven't seen it. On Saturday, to celebrate his defeat, he went out golfing with Newt Gingrich, among others, and on the same day, his campaign released a statement detailing his legal plans. The second paragraph of his statement was very interesting. It reads that beginning Monday, our campaign will start prosecuting our case in court to ensure election laws are fully upheld and the rightful winner is seated. The American people are entitled to an honest election. That means counting all legal ballots and not counting any illegal ballots. This is the only way to ensure the public has full confidence in our election. It remains shocking that the Biden campaign refuses to agree with this basic principle, completely untrue, and wants ballots counted even if they are fraudulent, manufactured, or cast by ineligible or deceased voters. Only a party engaged in wrongdoing would unlawfully keep observers out of the count room and then fight in court to block their access. Okay, so everything in the second paragraph is fine up until the third sentence where he says that it remains, or maybe the fourth sentence, it remains shocking that the Biden campaign refuses to agree with the basic principle that there should be a free and fair election and wants ballots counted even if they are fraudulent, manufactured, or cast by ineligible or deceased voters. Okay, that's just not true. He's very clearly called for a more fair election than Trump has himself. No one's ever done this before. No one's ever cast doubt on the results of an election. The only reason there are so many mail-in ballots is because people don't want to vote in person during a pandemic, one that has grown extremely rapidly under his watch. The funniest thing on this entire thing is that only a party engaged in wrongdoing would unlawfully keep observers out of the count room and then fight in court to block their access. So if you take the unlawfully keep observers out of the count room and then you just replace it with where the dash ends in this statement and you say only a party engaged in wrongdoing would then fight in court to block their access. I mean, that, or just the fight in court part more than anything, that is true hypocrisy, not only in Trump's, you know, existence as a person, but also his campaign and the statements that they put out. Very interesting stuff. Fraudulent election in Trump's vocabulary is defined as one that Trump didn't win. The other thing to observe about Trump's post-defeat strategy is that not a single Republican, notably the senior ones like Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, etc., are standing by his side at the moment. And none, you know, other than by just giving the vague call for fair, free, and non-fraudulent, fully counted, and legitimate elections, which are all things that all Americans should hope for. Before Biden's victory was even declared, actually well before that, Republican Representative Bill Hurd tweeted that a sitting president undermining our political process and questioning the legality of the vote of the voices of countless Americans without evidence is not only dangerous and wrong, it undermines the very foundation of this nation that this nation was built on. Every American should have his or her vote counted. And he's a Republican from the 23rd District of Texas. He then said on November 7th that it's time to come together, America has spoken, and we must respect the decision. More unites us than divides us. We can find common ground. I hope the president-elect can embody this. I wish him good luck, and I wish the president a successful final few weeks. God bless the USA. That should be precisely what Trump said. Of course, it is nearly impossible and paradoxical to expect that from Trump, but that would be a much better response from Trump, in my humble opinion, and I think in the opinion of a lot of Republicans behind closed doors, especially ones that have gone through a bunch of elections and have been on Capitol Hill for decades. Okay, I think that concludes our talking about Trump's voter fraud. We're going to get to the good stuff, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris's victory, next. But first, we must take a break. You are listening to the J. Doherty Podcast on the JD Media Network.
Subjective monologue on current events. A JD Media Network production.
You are listening to the J. Doherty Podcast. TJDP.
TJDP 2020 presidential election coverage.
That is correct, everyone. Welcome back to the J. Doherty Podcast. It is Sunday, November 8th, 2020, 5:06 p.m. as we come back from our short little break here on the J. Doherty Podcast. Thank you very much for being here. We are now going to talk about something that is much more exciting, much more better, and much more promising for the future of this country, a Biden-Harris victory. So Biden-Harris's victory is historic for many reasons. First, Joe Biden will be the second Catholic president to ever hold the office, and his running mate Kamala Harris will be the first woman to be the vice president, the first Black American to be vice president, the first South Asian American to be vice president. These are seriously historic achievements that everyone should be praising on both sides of the aisle in America, and I've seen a lot of Republicans be, you know, very proud of this historic achievement for both of them, but in particularly Kamala Harris. One of the classiest things I thought Vice President Pence did in his debate against Senator Harris was congratulate her on what he called the historic nature of her nomination in the debate. It should be no question that Republicans should be proud of the objectively historic occurrence of the nomination and victory of each of them, regardless of their policies. And a Biden-Harris victory really shows that it is still true that anyone can make it regardless of gender, skin color, etc., and that the truth actually matters to Americans, in my humble opinion. One of the interesting columns I saw in the Washington Post was one from Annie Linsky, who's a national political reporter focused on the 2020 presidential election. From Wilmington, Delaware, where all these Biden rallies are taking place, or celebrations are taking place. She writes, if there was one enduring symbol of Joe Biden's nationwide election night party Saturday night, it was the American flag. In the Riverfront District of Wilmington, near the parking lot from which Biden delivered his speech to the nation, flags flew everywhere. There was the big flag, a massive Old Glory hoisted between two cranes and visible from the interstate. It flew for a week as the ballot counting agonizingly continued, ripping at least twice and becoming a temporary Wilmington landmark. an American flag bigger than a barn door hung on the side of the Chase Center, which served as the backdrop for the victory speeches delivered by Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala D. Harris. Another draped vertically off the nearby wall of the Daniel S. Frawley Minor League Baseball Stadium, one more about a story high, was suspended from the side of the nearby Westin Hotel. What I think is very interesting is that there were a lot of Democrats, particularly ones that were really anti-Trump, that didn't want, they weren't proud to fly the American flag. They were embarrassed. And now, it is amazing. Just the best thing about this is that people on both sides can just generally feel proud to be an American citizen, or at least unembarrassed to be an American citizen at this current moment in time. The title of that column is "For Biden Fans, One Unifying Standard, Old Glory." It's on the front page of the Washington Post at the moment. And you can read it from the link to it is on the show notes of the J. Doherty Podcast, episode number 137. So Biden's official victory speech happened pretty late in the day, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Here are 3 minutes of the highlights that I wanted to play for you if you missed the speech. The first minute is a bunch of political cliches that sound great, and then the second half is raw truth and advice that all Americans should aspire to. Here's Biden.
The people of this nation have spoken. They've delivered us a clear victory, a convincing victory, a victory for we the people. We've won with the most votes ever cast from presidential ticket in the history of the nation, 74 million. What I must admit has surprised me, tonight we're seeing all over this nation, all cities and all parts of the country, indeed across the world, an outpouring of joy, of hope, renewed faith in tomorrow, bring a better day. And I'm humbled by the trust and confidence you placed in me. I pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide, but unify. Who doesn't see red states and blue states, only sees the United States. And work with all my heart, with the confidence of the whole people, to win the confidence of all of you. And for that, is what America, I believe, is about. It's about people. And that's what our administration will be all about. I sought this office to restore the soul of America, to rebuild the backbone of this nation, the middle class, and to make America respected around the world again, and to unite us here at home. It's the honor of my lifetime that so many millions of Americans have voted for that vision. And now, the work of making that vision is real. It's a task, the task of our time. I said at the outset, I wanted to represent this campaign to represent and look like America. We've done that. Now that's what I want the administration to look like and act like. For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now, let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies, they are Americans. They are Americans. The Bible tells us, to everything there is a season, a time to build, a time to reap, and a time to sow, and a time to heal. This is the time to heal in America. As my grandpa, our grandpa, used to say when I walked out of his home when I was a kid up in Scranton, he said, "Joey, keep the faith." And our grandmother, when she was alive, she yelled, "No, Joey, spread it. Spread the faith. God love you all. May God bless America, and may God protect our troops."
There we go.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
So that is, I thought, a very good speech. A lot of cliches, of course, things that he's used before, but very good speech, something that you need. I thought the fact that he said that it is very important that we respect the other side and that we, you know, come together as Americans and heal. Fantastic messages. And with the Biden administration, it seems like Democrats, or at least ones that are, you know, very far left, are no longer embarrassed to be American anymore. And no longer embarrassed to say, oh yeah, and like shrivel in pain that, oh yeah, that's my president up there, particularly in like liberal cities. And I know that's a different reality in a lot of the country and a lot of, you know, Republican states and counties that listen to this podcast. But, you know, where I am in Chicago and we're in a lot of densely populated places, you know, it's like considered morally deplorable to even wear a MAGA hat. But that's very different reality in West Virginia and other places within the United States. Part of the reason I think the left has gone so far left in the past 4 years is that they think that moving farther away from Trump's division and harmful rhetoric is the solution. That's not the solution at all. In fact, I would argue the opposite, that strategy is the exact opposite of the solution. When the going gets tough and the other side is as ruthless as Trump is, it is best to stay the course. Don't panic. Like, move forward. And maintaining centrism in a party. A healthy two-party system only works successfully, or at least moderately successfully, if Republicans and Democrats are each centered. That's what Barack Obama said. That's what Bill Clinton said. That's what George Bush has said. Like, it's sort of a general rule that in order for a two-party system to function healthily, each party has to be equally center as the other one. So after taking measures to reduce the continuing and underreported spread of COVID-19, throwing money at the economy to put people back to work, and assembling a strong team of advisors, cabinet members, and White House staff, soon-to-be President Biden should subtly focus on shifting the agenda of his party back to center-left. That is what he should focus on in the long term. That is what Clinton did, Carter did the same thing, and now I'm really hoping that Joe Biden stays the centrist course that he always has and completely rejects the word socialism from even being part of American vocabulary, because that term has gained popularity in large part due to Trump's division, because the left thinks that they need to go farther left in order to escape Trump's like harm. And I say all of that as a pretty socially liberal person, someone who was very strong on Biden, someone who really likes the policies that Joe Biden proposes. Biden has rejected socialism on the debate stage. Lots of Trump's rhetoric would make you believe otherwise, but his campaign rejection of socialism and extremely far-left policies should be put into a Biden administration. The rejection of those I'm talking about should be put into a Biden administration. And I hope to see that. If Biden can get coronavirus under control, if he can help reestablish businesses and small businesses and the middle class, if he can get people back to work, and if he can bring the Democrats as a party back to center-left, I will say that he's had a successful presidency. You know, assuming there are no other major issues that he fails on. Ironically, one of the biggest opponents of relatively far-left non-Biden policies has been his running mate Kamala Harris. You may remember this 60 Minutes interview, a clip of which I'm about to play, where Nora O'Donnell listed the disagreement Senator Harris has with the vice president, and she sort of quite literally laughs it off as if it's frivolous, when really, it's not frivolous at all. Here's the full clip from 60 Minutes.
You're very different in the policies that you've supported in the past. You're considered the most liberal United States senator.
Somebody said that, and it actually was Mike Pence on the debate stage, but...
Yeah, well, actually, the nonpartisan GovTrack has rated you as the most liberal senator. You supported the Green New Deal, you supported Medicare for All, you've supported legalizing marijuana. Joe Biden doesn't support those things. So are you going to bring the policies, those progressive policies that you supported as senator, into a Biden administration?
What I will do, and I promise you this, and this is what Joe wants me to do, this was part of our deal. I will always share with him my lived experience as it relates to any issue that we confront. And I promised Joe that I will give him that perspective and always be honest with him.
And is that a socialist or progressive perspective?
No. No, it is the perspective of a woman who grew up a black child in America, who was also a prosecutor, who also has a mother who arrived here at the age of 19 from India, who also, you know, likes hip hop, like What do you want to know?
Well, I want to give you the opportunity to address this, because at the Republican National Convention, yeah. President Trump made the case that Joe Biden is going to be nothing more than a Trojan horse for socialist policies, for the left wing of the Democratic Party. Are you going to push those policies when you're vice president of the United States?
I am not going to be confined to Donald Trump's definition of who I or anybody else is. And I think America has learned that that would be a mistake.
So just to button that up, because you have fought for Medicare for all. That's not something that Joe Biden supports. If you become vice president, would you say to a President Biden, you know what? We should really be pushing for Medicare for all, not a public option. That's just not going to do it. That's not my value.
I would not have joined the ticket if I didn't support what Joe was proposing.
So first, I want to say that Norah O'Donnell did a fantastic job, not just laughing it off like Harris did, and actually pushed her to get closer to the substance of her answer, which really came at the very end in which she said,
I would not have joined the ticket if I didn't support what Joe was proposing.
So why do I bring this entire thing up? Because I think the reason I bring it up is because I think it's very interesting to examine the strategy that candidates use when selecting their vice presidents. And the other thing, the reason I played that full clip, which you can find isolated on CBS's YouTube channel, 60 Minutes YouTube channel, is because I thought that exchange was fantastic, and I think Norah O'Donnell probably could have pushed her a little bit more. I think she did a fantastic job. She pushed her, I think, six times to get closer to an answer, or four times, five times, something like that. And the fact that she was able to say that Norah O'Donnell was able to get out of her that the reason I joined the ticket is because I wouldn't have joined the ticket, sorry, if I didn't support what Joe was pushing. That was a good answer, and that's sort of what Kamala Harris should have said instead of just 2 minutes of raw laughter and saying nothing. I mean, she should have instilled confidence in the supporters of Joe Biden's moderate policies, such as me, who want to know that Harris will be a backer of everything that Biden does. Back to the strategy that presidents use when they pick vice presidents and selecting their running mates. Former President Obama probably chose Joe Biden as a vice president, not only because they were very similar policy-wise, but also because Joe Biden had a plethora of connections in the Senate. And considering that Biden had been there since the dawn of time, it was politically advantageous to have an old schooler as your number one ally. Biden likely chose Harris because, first, she is more than qualified on paper for the position, and secondly, because there was a desperate need for diversity on the ticket. Without a doubt, it was two white men running against each other, and one white man had another white man as his running mate. It would not be fair at all to not have a person of color on the ticket or a woman on the ticket, not only to create equity, but also to have, you know, to be representative of all voices in America. It is crucial that the people who are leading America are representative of the experiences of most or all Americans. And it was crucial for Biden statistically to have a woman on the ticket. And apologies in advance for the tangent here, but Kamala Harris's nomination helped Joe Biden with gaining the woman vote more than any other demographic. According to The Guardian, Joe Biden raised $26 million in 24 hours after announcing the Kamala Harris pick. The amount was seen as a sign of strength and momentum behind Biden's campaign brought on by Harris's arrival. Donald Trump's fundraising in July topped Biden's by nearly $30 million, bringing in a total of $165 million, compared with Biden's $140 million, but the former vice president is closing the gap, which, of course, he continued to do. And, you know, this is something really, you always see tons of money going to the incumbent. And it ended up being that a lot of women actually ended up supporting Joe Biden after Kamala Harris's nomination, and helped with getting women to join the Biden ticket after Kamala Harris was nominated. CNN had an exclusive analysis which said that the Biden-Harris ticket received more than $33.4 million in itemized contributions from women in August. That's more than double the $13.7 million that the Democrats' campaign had collected from female donors the previous month. Contributions are itemized or disclosed along with the donor's identifying information to federal regulators once donors contribute more than $200 to a candidate. By comparison, CNN says Trump's campaign raised far less money, roughly $8.7 million in itemized contributions from women in August, the month both he and Biden accepted their party's nominations. Continuing on my tangent here, I also want to point out that perhaps this election was a fantastic victory for women all around the country, particularly Republican women. It was something that Trump was very concerned about in securing the weeks up to the election, a demographic that he was very concerned about securing. I mean, there was a ridiculous clip where he talks about how suburban women need to like him. I mean, he said it jokingly, but the way he phrased it was just not good. And I don't want to even get into that right now. But anyway, NBC News reports that more women than ever before were elected into the Congress, the United States Congress. So the number of women in Congress has steadily climbed since 1981, they say, when just 17 women served in both the House and the Senate. In the 2018 midterms, an impressive 127 women were elected. Experts thought that spike may have been an anomaly, but the latest results demonstrate otherwise, according to the experts who are analyzing this. The other thing that you won't probably hear a lot of the media talk about is that this was the first time that there have never been more Republican women elected to Congress in history. Republican women elected to Congress in history, not just women, but Republican women. A worthwhile achievement that I'm sure the media has told you nothing about. Here's the president mentioning that in his otherwise disastrous and inaccurate press conference on November 5th.
This was also the year of the Republican woman. More Republican women were elected to Congress than ever before. That's a great achievement.
And that is a great achievement. And it is, overall, the increase of women in politics, particularly in Congress on both sides of the aisle, is a fantastic achievement and a much needed one. This has concluded my tangent. We now return to coverage of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's victory. Okay, so I have now talked about the plethora of reasons Joe Biden chose Kamala Harris to be his vice president. I will now talk about how she reacted and what she said during her victory speech and introduction to Joe Biden at their campaign event. Going off the idea that she is drastically more far left and to the point of incohesiveness in their administration than Biden, I thought the fact that she used the word loyal in her promise to Biden in her introduction speech was something very notable, because it does promise and assure the American public, including Biden, that she will indeed stand by him policy-wise and ideology-wise.
No matter who you voted for, I will strive to be a vice president like Joe was to President Obama. Loyal, honest, and prepared, waking up every day thinking of you and your family.
Okay, so ideally, the vice president-elect will be Biden's point person for working in the Senate, as Biden was for Obama, and on a number of issues that he may also want to task her with. Because Biden, knew foreign policy, he knew people in the Senate, he helped develop the Affordable Care Act. Hopefully, Biden can sort of assign her tasks or sort of things that she should she focuses on as a vice president, and I think that would be a successful thing and an ideal thing to do. Otherwise, the vice president, as in all roles, generally just goes to weddings and funerals and things that the president is too busy to actually attend, but still make a big deal out of the appearance and everything. So if she can hop on the boat to what I like to call the quiet island of moderate Democrats, then she should. She absolutely should. If she can do that, and if she joins the quiet island of moderate Democrats with Joe Biden and learns that, in my humble opinion, center-left and centrism is more important than super-progressive ideologies that really wouldn't do much for anyone and would just create more division and are ideologically incorrect, in my opinion, or at least not good, in my opinion, then I think she should. If she can become more moderate, she can transform her beliefs and join Joe Biden as the vice president, she absolutely should. Here's the extended version of that end of that introduction to Biden. Here's Kamala Harris.
No matter who you voted for, I will strive to be a vice president like Joe was to President Obama. Loyal, honest, and prepared, waking up every day thinking of you and your family. Because now is when the real work begins, the hard work, the necessary work, the good work, the essential work to save lives and beat this epidemic, to rebuild our economy so it works for working people, to root out systemic racism in our justice system and society, to combat the climate crisis, to unite our country and heal the soul of our nation. And the road ahead will not be easy, but America is ready, and so are Joe and I. We have elected a president who represents the best in us, a leader the world will respect and our children will look up to, a commander-in-chief who will respect our troops and keep our country safe, and a president for all Americans.
All right, so the ending of her speech there before the actual introduction of Biden acts as a fantastic conclusion to this podcast. While I disagree with the legislative track record that Senator Harris has had in the Senate and some of the policies she's advocated for in the past, I think there is no doubt in my mind that America has elected a more moral, decent, kind, and honest president than the one that we have now, or the president-elect that we have now. Or sorry, than the president we have now, and the president-elect is going to be obviously more moral, decent, kind, and honest than the president that we have now. This is a triumphant moral victory for our nation, the fact that Joe Biden has won. People are not drawn into the moral failure of the current president's character. People are once again proud to live in America and be in America today. At least from what I've observed, Joe Biden will be a lot more inclusive, in my opinion, of Republican perspectives than Donald Trump was of Democrat perspectives. And in my opinion, the future of our nation, the relative peace on our streets, and the future lack of divisiveness makes me very, very, very hopeful for this country. If Biden can restore faith, hope, and as he talks about, and so does Harris talk about, if they can restore faith, hope, and heal America, if he can bring the Democratic Party back to center left, if he can stop the coronavirus's harmful spread, if he can put people back to work, if he can fix small businesses, and if he can get us one step closer to uniting the nation, I will consider him to have a very successful presidency. The phone number for this podcast is 312-625-8492. You can receive emails and newsletter updates at j-story.com/newsletter. Read and listen to show notes and episode highlights at j-story.com. Clips and highlights at thedortyfiles.com. This has been a JD Media Network production. Thank you so much for listening. Podcast is written, hosted, produced, and edited by Jay Doherty. The Jay Doherty Podcast is a JD Media Network production. Copyright Jay Doherty 2020. Make sure to listen to other JD Media Network productions, like the JDRC Politics Podcast for discussions on international politics, or the Weekly File for all the news, just the facts. Learn more and hear more of this content at j-doherty.com or view archived clips and show highlights at thedoertyfiles.com. Thank you for listening to the Jay Doherty Podcast.
TJDP! The JD Media Network.